This morning we have a terrific assessment plenary session for you. We've called it Assessment Excellence in Digital Education. And in my time in this role, when I've talked to RTOs, assessment has been a key area that people sometimes struggle with in how do I've delivered online, I've delivered using a whole range of different flexible learning techniques. How can I translate this into assessment? How can I take this forward and how can I be sure that it's going to meet the standard that's required? So to address that question this morning, we have three panellists with us. I'll pass over initially to Michael Coughlin, who's going to facilitate this session for us. Michael is an e-learning facilitator with TAFE South Australia. He is also an independent e-learning consultant and has a great deal of experience and knowledge and across a wide range of areas. And I think we'll find what he has to say quite interesting. Over to you, Michael. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. So welcome to this panel session on Assessment Excellence in Digital Education. I'm going to take us back in time for 10 minutes in a short segment called Technology and Assessment, A Brief History. I began teaching in TAFE in 1989 and I heard a phrase in the car on the way to here this morning where people who work for that long in TAFE are called lifers. I never imagined when I came into TAFE that I might eventually end up being a lifer, but there you go, 20 years and I'm still here. When I began teaching in TAFE, I had my class, I was an ESL, English as a Second Language teacher, I had my grammar books, my texts, and I had the technology, and that was the technology I used there, a cassette player, in fact that's a fairly modern looking cassette player, and a TV. And an interesting thing to note about the technology that I used back in 1989 was the technology that I used in the classroom was exactly the same technology that people used at home. And in terms of assessment, it's just astounding to think back. I had a roll book, and at the end of semester, I put competency achieved or not achieved, and that was it. No one looked at it, no one cared. That was the assessment process. When you think about media in delivery of your classroom practice, it's really interesting to go back, and some of you may have done this, and for people under the age of 30, this is going to be a bit of a history lesson. People over the age of 30, you'll remember what I'm talking about. If you were crazy enough to want to show a film in a classroom back then, you had to go through this massive big catalogue of all the things that were available without any real information about whether or not it was a good movie or not, but you took the punt. You filled out the order form, and in my case, I sent it off to the South Australian Film Corporation. A week or two later, the film would arrive on campus. The library would let me know. I'd go down and get this huge monster of a machine and take it home, typically, and set it up and run the movie at home so I could vet it and prepare assignments in connection with the movie. The whole process from go to woe was about 2 weeks. You had to be incredibly organised if you wanted to show a film in the classroom. Photos were kind of in a similar vein. I mean, you took photos and then you had rolls of film and they came in rolls of 12, 24 or 36. So you took your film and whether or not you needed three photos or four, you had to take at least 12 because that was the smallest amount of film that you could get on a roll. And then who remembers what you did with these rolls of film? Where did you take them? To the chemist. We took them to the chemist. I mean, it's so cute now to think back, really. So cute and quaint. And if you were really lucky, that chemist actually, if you had a few dud photos, they wouldn't charge you for them. But most of the time they did. So you'd get your roll of 24 back and five of them were dark or blank or unusable, but you paid for them anyway. Again, the process took at least a week, probably two. So you've got your photographs. How do you show a photograph in a classroom back then? There were only two options. You handed it around, which, you know, grubby, very inefficient, or you put it on an overhead projector and the production was ridiculous, I mean, just unusable, or you could have photocopied it and handed that around again, production unusable, very inferior thing. So you just didn't do it. Videos were interesting too. You actually had to look through the programs on TV and it was usually the ABC and you selected the stuff that you wanted to have taped. You went down to the library, you asked the library to record them for you and then the library would store the cassette when the day was had come to teach this in the classroom, you'd go and get this contraption, you'd wheel it into your room. If there's one around, I used to go into the classroom the day before, typically set it up, know it was there, you'd come there in the morning and it's gone because there was a night class and they've used it. So you'd go hunting for the thing. There'd be typically two amongst five or six classrooms, but eventually you'd get your video and you'd bring it in and you'd play it. Again, time frame between thinking, I'd like to show a video, and actually showing the video at least a week. The sorts of things you might, I mean, if you were crazy enough to actually create a video for your own purpose, you used a great big clot-hopping thing like that Sharp that I had in 1990. It still works. These days, I've got this little flip video. It's kind of shrunk a little. But we enter the 21st century, enter the digital age, and up here I have this flip video. I have cameras which record. I have a camera which records stills and movies. I have an MP3 player which records audio, and I have a phone which records audio and pictures and movies. So I've got five devices right here in front of me which would all fit into my pocket. So I've got total editorial control over that. It takes me about 2 minutes to use any of these and get stuff on the internet. And we've entered the world of disintermediation, or otherwise called the decline of the gatekeepers, where once upon a time everything that we ever used in a magazine or a record, newspaper, film, was always vetted by someone else. It went through a process of editorial control and was deemed okay for public consumption. That's all gone. Any one of us now can put stuff up in the public domain in a matter of minutes, whether it's got any quality or whether it's inappropriate, offensive, brilliant. We make the decisions, and the community makes the decision after it's gone live whether or not it's any good. So this book, I'll just recommend it quickly, Here Comes Everybody, Clay Shirky. If you want a wonderful read about how this stuff has changed the way we live, this is the best book in my opinion, Here Comes Everybody. We're talking about these sites. I'm not going to list them. You'll be familiar with a lot of them. These are the places where people are putting the content they create with these incredibly small mobile devices. How you feel about this really can come back to how you see the world. So whether your values tell you the masses are basically stupid and not to be trusted and I'm the sole authority here, or whether or not you're the kind of person who is more likely to believe in collective wisdom and more heads are better than one. Usually, of course, the truth is somewhere in the middle, but how you feel about the masses is going to dictate how you operate in this new field of user-generated media. Why does media matter? Adrian Miles from the RMIT in Melbourne makes the point that we need to make our institutions more porous to students' private technologies, their phones, their laptops and their cameras. And the point I made earlier about when I started teaching in TAFE, the technology we used in TAFE was exactly the same as the technology we used at home is no longer the case. So what we're all using in our private lives now is quite different to what's typically happening inside classrooms. I like to mention this innate human desire, need to create. Most of you in your private time will write, you might draw, you might create pottery, you might be an artist, you might sing, you might dance. You will have something that comes under that banner of creative output. We seem to keep that pretty well locked away in an average classroom performance, well, when we teach or lecture or go to work in TAFE or VET. These new tools make it incredibly easy. I mean, these tools are everywhere, and the ease with which we can create media to satisfy creative urges of ourselves and our students, the world has changed. So images, films, documents, course content, assessments, we can do all of that with this new media, and it satisfies, in my opinion, this innate human desire or need to create. And of course, it's part of this wider, larger term, digital literacy. This is an old study now, but I'm sure if you could look at more recent studies of this same question. Courses that contain media always produce better results in terms of student outcomes. It's pretty much a simple, plain fact. So we've got all of these people too in our classrooms. English is a second language level, people with low levels of literacy, those with little formal learning experience, those with poor keyboard skills, and those who prefer an auditory style of learning. And we could add to these categories. But if you look at those categories, I bet there's a lot of people in this room that fit into one or more of these. There's thousands of us who reading and writing really isn't our preferred mode of learning or being assessed. We'd much prefer to operate in a world where media was valued. So the impact of all of this, this is a complicated slide, but sums up, there's a shift from the left to the right. This new media and its emphasis on user-generated content, and the user could be a student, the user could be you as teachers, trainers, lecturers, move towards informal learning, more personalized learning, more collaborative, more creative, where the personal author and innovator is more emphasized or part of the educational transaction, and a move from content to knowledge and understanding. We could have a whole day's discussion on this slide, but suffice to say right now that things are shifting across to the right more and more. So what constitutes fair and valid e-assessment, which is a central question of why we're here this morning? And just as a few examples, a video created by an apprentice using point-of-view technology, these things, somewhere in remote Australia to prove that he or she is competent at fitting service gauges. Is this valid and reliable evidence? A Wimber voice board. Any voice recordings or are voice recordings of a student engaged in a scenario posed online in a voice discussion board, are they enough to show a lecturer or auditor that they have the customer relationship skills required for a unit of competence in hospitality? In an assignment conducted entirely in a learning management system, Blackboard, Janus and Moodle, where there's no paper record of the task or the assessment activity, is that okay? Is a video or photographs created by a student on their mobile phone showing the various stages of cutting someone's hair sufficient to demonstrate competence? Or in the last example I'm going to pose as generic examples of the kind of things that we may want to do, is a video created by a student of one of his peers to demonstrate their competence in the safe use of hand and power tools sufficient evidence for an auditor? And we're going to have a quick look at this last example, and I do need to mention that there are copyright issues associated with this, which you might like to think about, but as we're here this morning for the purposes of educational instruction, we're going to just play a couple of minutes of this video of a young man who used this video as assessment. There we go. We'll just let this run for a couple of minutes. This was a case where a lecturer gave students the option of creating a little digital story to satisfy the requirements of safe use of hand and power tools. And they worked in pairs. What it does, it moves into the student himself showing that he's got no rings on, that his hands are clear, that he's wearing safety glasses, he's got the appropriate footwear, his shirt's tucked in, and this is all being filmed by his friend. And just an interesting question, is that a valid form of assessment? It's time to move on to our next panellist, and I shall introduce Margaret and welcome her before we have asked Margaret to come to the microphone. Margaret is the Director of the Vocational Education and Training Accreditation Board for VTAB, or VTAB, which is responsible for the registration of training organisations and the accreditation of courses against the National Australian Quality Training Framework. Prior to joining VTAB, Margaret worked in a number of areas of the State Training Services Directorate of the Department, managing programs to support the developing training market and to improve the quality of training delivery. Margaret, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Over to you.
Good morning, everybody. I'm very happy to be here. I have to say that by no means do I consider myself to be an expert in e-assessment. But I am here to give you a little bit of a view of VTAB's view of assessment / e-assessment. I would imagine that the group of people here are right out at the forefront, at the cutting edge of training, and that the number of providers that are actually involved in this is not a significant number at this point in time, because it's certainly not an issue that comes to my attention a lot. And before I came to this conference, I did email out to the auditors to, give me some input. So, but I hope that what I have to say is of interest to you. So firstly, I want to come at it from how important is assessment. And for us, assessment is an absolutely foundational, critical pillar of the national training system. Consistency of assessment is something that is absolutely fundamental if the community at large, if industry, are going to have confidence in the system. And I think that what we see with our national system, we've got all the pillars, we've got all the good materials and everything, but we do have a bit of a crisis of confidence when it comes to, for example, pushing the agenda of coherence or the coming together of regulation and training packages. So we do need to make sure that in assessment that we do have confidence of others and that people that have the qualification actually have those skills. The AQTF, one of our foundational pillars, talks about assessment all through it. Standard 1.2, Standard 1.4, Standard 1.5. I mean, it's all about assessment. So it's not that it's not up front and centre that assessment is important. The training packages spell out assessment. We have critical aspects of evidence in our units of competency. We have, you know, the assessment sections, so that assessment has been absolutely emphasised as being important, and it's routinely audited. I mean, if any provider ever wants to get a qualification on their scope, they've got to give us a learning and assessment strategy, and they have to give us two sample assessment tools from two units of competency. So we do require people to demonstrate that they've actually wrestled with the training package, that they've customised the learning and assessment strategy, and that their assessment tools, we don't like commercial assessment tools, that doesn't necessarily tell us anything. We like customised assessment tools for their particular groups that they're going to deliver to. In terms of capacity to deliver, there are certainly units of competency in the TAA around e-assessment and around assessment to make sure that people can go out and get the skills if they, you know, if they're feeling unsure in the area. But is there a problem? Well, what I've listed here are the areas of non-compliance that as auditors we come up most against. And I've got three slides here, and a lot of those issues are around assessment. They don't involve sufficient evidence. They don't comply with the assessment guidelines. Assessments don't comply with principles of assessment. The assessment doesn't lead to the AQF qualification or the statement of attainment. They're not relevant. They don't focus on the knowledge skill requirements for the workplace. I mean, there's a lot of serious issues around assessment. The delivery strategies did not identify the target group and the modes and the strategies. Requirements of the training package are not met, so on and so on. So there are lots of issues for us around assessment. Recent national money that's going into the various projects on assessment is very welcomed by us. We've been pushing this one for a long time. If you're going to do anything about the system, you've got to do something about assessment. So let's ask, what are the problems? Are the problems with the AQTF? If there are problems with the AQTF, it's possibly around really establishing capacity to deliver. I think the standards themselves spell out the importance of assessment all the way through them. At the end of the day, does the provider really understand what they're meant to be doing and have the capacity to deliver? What about the training packages? Training packages have improved, but the training packages also need to really specify. You know, we don't like wishy-washy language. We don't like may and mights. We like very definite language about what what the provider must do, what the student must demonstrate. Auditors and auditing or VTAB, the problem with all of this. I think that's kind of an easy way out. I think that the auditors and auditing and VTAB try very hard to be right out there to really make a very fair judgment against the standards on the one hand, on the training package on the other, and with the RTO. I think AQTF 2007 has come a long way and allows for the professional discussion and the professional dialogue. And if you can defend what you're doing, that's what we like to happen, an engagement and a defence of what you're doing. And as long as you have really thought through an assessment strategy, and from the perspective of e-assessment, it's not just because you've got the technology and, knowledge tests are easy and we'll do some yes-no answers or multiple choice questions because we've got the technology to do it. That's not really the starting point. The starting point is a well-thought-out assessment strategy of how you're going to assess this qualification in a fair and valid and authentic way. That's what we like to see, and that's the dialogue we like to have. So in terms of seeing examples, is anything out? Well, nothing is necessarily out as long as they're sufficient, as long as it's current, as long as it's authentic, and as long as you can, as an assessor, tick off against all those qualities in terms of your assessment plan for a particular qualification or student, that's what we need to see. Capacity and capability of assessors, I think, yes, that for example, the problems we see, that is a problem, and lack of infrastructure. And I think definitely lack of infrastructure. Are there enough assessor networks? Are there enough good models? Is there enough research going on? Are there enough PD opportunities? And I'd have to say, in my view, given the importance of assessment, no, there's not. And anything that happens in that direction is certainly welcomed. So what does the auditor look for? The auditor looks for the learning and assessment strategy that meets the requirement of the package. Assessment meets the requirements of the units of competency. The assessors are appropriately qualified. And, of course, the principles of assessment and the rules of evidence are met in the particular assessments. And that's just another way of saying that they meet the requirements of 1.2, 1.3 and 1.5. So what do we know about e-assessments? I think any form of assessment, we know that learners need to be supported through the process. And in e-assessment, more so, the learner definitely needs to be supported in terms of the information, upfront information about how they're going to be assessed and what it involves. Infrastructure to support them so that technology that works and knowledge that the student themselves know how to work this technology so that technology is not a barrier. And educational support for the students and making sure that the student does have access to a trainer or a teacher to support them along the way. And access to the assessors. I think it's very important that the learner support is foremost in your minds as you work with all this terrific technology. We saw an excellent example. This one was emailed through to me, but we were examining some tourism qualifications recently, and I guess it was made to measure, but travel reservation system on Galileo, where the participants can get in and make bookings and solve problems with an excellent database, not a real life database, but an excellent database at the back. So we have seen examples of excellent e-assessments. Is it a good way to test underpinning knowledge? Well, it's certainly a very easy way to test underpinning knowledge, and it's important to test underpinning knowledge. But I think it's not just for the sake of doing it. You've got the technology, so let's do the short answer questions or the multiple choice questions. It does have to be part of a well thought out assessment strategy, and it's about the assessment strategy and the trainer driving the program and seeing how technology can support it rather than the technology driving the training program and the assessment. Is every qualification suitable for e-assessment? Some units of most qualifications, rarely all of a qualification. Some qualifications spell out very clearly that there must be workplace assessment. That's very clear, and I think, you know, it's hard to argue how the workplace assessment is going to be done if you're going to try and e-assess it. If Okay, thank you. If we're looking at a qualification that's put forward to us for full e-assessment and e-delivery, we would hone in straight away on the soft skills. And here's an example of one: communicate with clients as part of agency operations. And what the student needs to demonstrate is active listening, appropriate questioning, empathy, observation, reassurance, and confirmation. So, you know, you'd have to have a good debate with us about how your assessment tools actually can assess those particular soft skills. I picked out two because there were two training packages, two recent ones that really raised some questions. Some of those were from the health training package, where they spell out quite clearly, observation of workplace performance is essential for this unit. And the observation should include the safety requirements and the duty of care requirements. The other one is the CITO 7, and all the commercial cookery units. We just had a look at prepare, cook and serve Asian food for food service, and that particular unit of competency, you need to produce a range of menu items. You need the ability to multitask. It says you've got to collect direct evidence showing preparation for a minimum of 12 complete food service periods. So you really do need to know your training package, know your critical aspects of evidence, know the assessment, the evidence guides very well before you launch off into looking at how you might do e-assessment and e-delivery, when I think you would have a hard job in arguing that those qualifications can be delivered solely in that way. I think there's a question about is every student suitable for e-delivery? And I guess we only get the feedback on that through complaints, where students complain to us and have not been able to resolve it, obviously, with their RTO, about the mode of delivery. And I think it's possibly true that not everybody is either equipped with the IT skills, or maybe the hardware or the access or whatever, for e-delivery, and that's something that you need to give a thought to. A simple computer literacy test might be a way to do a sorting at that area. And then finally, about the industry regulator. If you're looking at e-delivery for qualifications that are attached to licensing, this is a particularly, I guess it's a fraught area. We're working very hard to get the confidence of the regulators. Does the regulator have an opinion? And that's something that really needs to be taken into account, because at the end of the day, you can deliver the qualification, but if it doesn't meet the regulator's requirements, then your student's not going to get their licence. So the regulators have strong views for lots of reasons, basically because it has been their patch traditionally and they've maintained standards, and also because we've seen some unfortunate cases of where we've tried to make this happen too quickly, and we've ended up, you know, we've ended up in difficult situations, including in ICAC, over the models. So you do need to be wary for regulators. Best practice e-assessment, a range of assessment strategies, integrated learning and assessment, giving feedback to online learners, and authenticity, just making sure that the evidence that you've got is authentic. So I think that, you know, you're right out at the forefront. We look forward really to getting more, getting involved in this more, and becoming more e-connected ourselves as a regulator. But, you know, I hope that what I've been able to say certainly throws light from where we come at this problem from. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Margaret. I was pleased to read on the slide that you, where you listed the problems, that the problems, none of them were associated with the E part of assessment. I'd like to introduce our next panellist, my friend and colleague from Adelaide, Annie Ferguson. Annie is the Business Manager for Research and Benchmarking with the Australian Flexible Learning Framework. and is currently managing an innovative research project looking at the issues around assessment in digital formats and seeking to provide examples of best practice. Annie, over to you.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for that. Firstly, it's a great opportunity to be here at eLearning 09 in New South Wales, and I'd really like to congratulate you, firstly, for taking the time to reflect and engage at this conference. And from my experience, my background as a teacher and manager in TAFE South Australia and private providers, I think it's the bit that we don't do very well, where there's so many expectations on vet organisations, educators, facilitators, trainers, and our role, our business, is it really about motivating other people, motivating our students to get jobs, motivating our staff, and yet we quite often don't take the time to actually replenish ourselves and motivate ourselves. And we are in, as we say, we're needing to live with change, get used to change. So I really congratulate you for taking the time to look at new innovations to take back to your teams. As Michael said, I'm based in Adelaide. My team are based in Canberra, Victoria, and I work with a national benchmarking research project of the Australian Flexible Learning Framework. My role is to manage a survey, an annual survey that goes out to trainers, vet organisations and employers every year, and also to look at commissioned research. So before I go into talking about the e-assessment commissioned research, I just want to take you through, I guess, why we're involved in this research and how this all came about. Okay, so when I look at this, I think initially I thought, yep, fantastic, we're all in tomorrow. But when I look at some of the benchmarking survey results, I start to think, where are we on the continuum? I encourage you to take time to think about where are you on the continuum. Not all of our students are in the tomorrow. Many of us are. Michael took me back to yesterday very quickly. I was having nightmares of being taught at Teachers College how to use spools of film and overhead projectors that just seemed like yesterday. And many of our students coming into the vet sector are kind of, moving through the area of perhaps not knowing a lot about e-learning and technology to those that are cutting edge. So I think it's important as educators to understand that not everybody is at the cutting edge. And our survey certainly shows we talk about 50% of people using e-learning and teachers using e-learning, but that means particularly a lot of small businesses aren't engaged in e-learning and don't quite know where to start. Just to quickly take you through that, as I said, we run a national benchmarking survey that goes out to 700 RTOs, 1,500 teachers, 1,600 students and 800 employers each year. So it's quite a big sample to feed back into what sort of research that we should be doing. And as the employer survey, we actually looked at 400 employers who did not have a vet connection. So we were looking at really attitudes and what employers were saying about training and what their knowledge of e-learning or technology in teaching and training was. So some of the key messages that, and I'm just giving you a real snapshot. I mean, I'm sure you've all are familiar with the benchmarking survey report and have read it from cover to cover, but I'll just give you a little taste of what the survey was showing. So 90% of students want some e-learning. And this isn't a big change from 2008 to 2009 and 2008. Very similar. So we're sort of seeing a bit of a e means expectation, perhaps not e-learning. The expectation is there that RTOs will offer some sort of technology. So we really focused our 2009 survey on not on the if, but how. How were teachers doing it? So we're really trying to look at the pedagogic ideas behind the teaching and learning. So flexibility is a major factor. People will vote with their feet in terms of looking at if an RTO offers a blended approach. The survey showed significant increase in the use of Web 2.0. And organisational support. So organisations now are recognising that is core business. They really need to be engaged. And so it was really great to see a lot more organisations having an e-learning strategy. How many organisations that you work for have an e-learning strategy? Just show of hands. So if I'd asked that question a couple of years ago, maybe not. So it might be within your work group, your work team, or your organisation there's a real shift to being much more supportive of e-learning. So as I said, we focused really in 2009 on what the teachers are saying, and 50% of teachers say that e-learning allows students to tailor learning, increasing more personalised approach, improving their teachers' practice and improving learning outcomes. And teachers were saying that they are now more engaged with their practice, more engaged with their students and more engaged with the work they're doing. And that's really interesting because I'm not sure that I was seeing that a couple of years ago. So we're seeing teachers now saying, yeah, this is exciting. I might have resisted it for a while, but now I'm really engaged and enjoying it. Not just the students, I'm enjoying it. And just the employer survey, you can see that there's quite an increase of employers' knowledge of e-learning and using technology from 2005 to 2009. Whilst they may not be using it, they are aware of its benefits. I don't think I said anything that I'd written on my notes. Okay, so just a background. We also run a commissioned research project where I project manage research, and we look at what the surveys are saying, what the Horizon report's saying, and we also do quite a bit of research into what we will research. So in 2008, we were talking to NCVR and a number of stakeholders around VET with this sense, and what came out of that was there was a contribution that the framework would make, and in particular our benchmarking project, in relation to e-assessment. So what came out of it, there is a perception that some of those currently conducting OQTF auditing are suspicious or unsympathetic to e-learning evidence, whether that's true or not. So it's not clear whether perception is justified. So we decided to put a brief together, which has been conducted by Professor Burr and Professor Victor Callan from Queensland University, and Berwyn Clayton, who's very knowledgeable in the area of assessment. Many of you possibly would know of her work. They're looking at examining and promoting a greater understanding of issues in relation to e-learning and assessment, and to look at the key issues current e-learning assessment practices. So at the moment, where's that research at? The literature review has been completed, which is available for anybody who actually is in draft form. So if you'd like to look at the work that's been done so far, the findings that have occurred, and next year we'll be looking at the consultation. We'll be interviewing practitioners, auditors, regulatory boards, etc., to actually bring people together to talk about what are those issues and how can we actually perhaps work towards a common understanding or common guidelines to actually provide knowledge and professional development within the sector. I looked at this, what is e-assessment? You can just read that definition, but when I actually had a bit of a read through it, I think it talks about it's becoming widely used. It's a generic term described the use of computers within the assessment process. But I'm not sure it's just computers. I think we've already... this is an outdated... Yes, Melanie's saying we've passed that, so change that slide. With all the, point-of-view glasses, the mobile learning, there is a lot of work being done, not only by the framework in looking at innovative technologies for e-assessment or assessment in general, but it's not just about computers anymore, is it? So, as I said, the literature review is just, as I said, completed, and I'd encourage you to have a look at it. And it is about getting assessment right, and as Margaret said, acknowledging our system and acknowledging that it is the pillar or the cornerstone of VET, and we need to get that right. As technology becomes more sophisticated, we're really needing to make sure our staff and our system are, and our people are actually prepared for, have the opportunity to use all of the tools available. Okay. So just very quickly, so we saw this opportunity to work with the flexible learning framework, saw the opportunity where we could contribute with our knowledge and background and our previous research in the area of reassessment. So we looked at the NQC research, the National Quality Council research, and they've identified a number of gaps. So I won't go through all those, but one of them is looking at competency-based assessment in an online environment. So we believe that there are perhaps an opportunity to look at case studies, really good examples to share with auditors, teachers, trainers, assessors and organisations. And some of the group discussion we had in South Australia was looking at the first thing people often ask me is how do you validate students are the ones who completed the assessment? All of those issues. So do some of those things look familiar to you, some of those concerns? So what I was going to show you an example of the QTI in play, but what I am more interested in doing is actually hearing your opinions. You've heard Margaret today, you've heard Michael talk about the ubiquitous nature of technology, and so I'd really like to have an opportunity to listen to what your challenges and issues are in your area. And so I just posed a question about sharing how your organisations or industry can use e-learning. What lessons are being learnt for future developments around e-assessment? What's your experience, your concerns or your challenges? So how I'd like to do this, whilst it's not a conducive room for sitting around using a butcher's paper and all of that, I'd like you to actually form a little team with the people behind you and next to you have a bit of a chat for the next 5 minutes about what are your particular challenges. Have you been surprised what you've heard this morning? What are your concerns, or would you just like to make a comment on the research that's being undertaken? So for the next 5 minutes, could you just chatter away to the people behind you and next to you about some of those challenges, and we'll bring you back in 5 minutes to actually feedback.
If I could ask you to wind up your conversations.
Fantastic. Sorry to make you stop, but we do just want to give you an opportunity to ask questions or make comments to people on the panel. So are there questions or comments that you and the group that you were talking with just then would like to share with anyone up here? And we have roaming mics and we have a question down the front. So
David McElvenny from Workspace Training. We run courses in the timber industry, and one of the courses we deliver is the TAA. The timber industry is very traditional, and we still do all our assessments on the job, face-to-face. But I'm keen to know VTAB's view, Margaret, of TAA assessment evidence, particularly for the delivery of competencies, because I know that some RTOs seem to be happy with videos of people delivering to their students.
Well, I don't think that there are any particular rules, but I think that you have to be able to defend your assessment evidence as being, you know, current, authentic, reliable, valid. And that's really what we would look at. We would ask to see your assessment evidence and have the discussion with you. And if it holds together, that could be perfectly fine. And if it doesn't hold together, if it's just a series of, you know, unrelated whatever, I think that's where we would challenge you. I don't think that there's any definites in this. It's about the providers engaging with the package, engaging with their strategies, and being able to defend those strategies.
Warren Wilson from MindSkill Australia, and also a representative of HUDA Trainers and Assessors Network, as Margaret well knows. And the question is for Margaret. In terms of engaging with practitioners in relation to e-assessment, there's been discussion clearly amongst your audit staff about what works and what doesn't work and problems they have with some of those assessment issues. Is there likely to be an opportunity for fora where auditors and practitioners can get together and discuss what they'd like to see happen in the context of the assessment?
Look, I think that those situations have to be staged for us. We recently took part in Ask an Auditor on the RPL online network, and I think that that's probably on the RPL site. I mean, it's not something that we really are resourced to put on ourselves, much and all as we like to participate. The auditors have, you know, their caseloads of audits on their desks to get through, so that's why it's difficult to get them along. But we are happy if it's set up for us. We're more than happy to take part in constructive discussions about those things.
Adrian Laws from TAFE in Wagga. Two questions, if I can. One was on the board there on the screen a minute ago about how can you validate if assessments are completed online with students. And the other one was relating to the QTIM player, if there's anything in the pipeline for getting any other assessment events that we can put onto that.
How would you validate
assessment online?
Is online. But I mean, I think what we're seeing in the surveys and what we, you know, what our experience has been that it's a blended approach. So we'll often see some online formative assessment. There need to be some validation or verification from a manager or a supervisor in the workplace that this is indeed, you know, the person who has completed the actual online survey or assessment. So it's no different from, I guess, the paper-based where people were able to actually, how do you prove somebody hands in a hard copy assignment? So I think you need to put instructions in place and have a really good process for working with your student to make sure that that's validated. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
And any more opportunities with the QTI player?
The QTIM player, have people seen it? So maybe what in the break we could actually put it on while... Is that possible, Melanie?
Yes, that's fine. We can keep it running through morning tea and... Adrian's actually got it on his phone.
Oh, okay. It's a mobile device. It was developed through the Flexible Learning Framework project funding by Peter Hicks, and so he'd be more than happy for people to contact him. And it has it is AQTF compliant. So if you are interested in that, I encourage you to have a look at that in the break.
Hi, Stuart Webster from the Office of State Revenue. We're not an RTO, but we. Last 12 or 18 months we've got e-learning strategies in place. The type of programs that I deal with tend to be on the more higher levels of management. How do you collect evidence from senior staff on dealing with like really, really sensitive topics like potential union issues and all that type of stuff to demonstrate their competence in those type of skills?
I'm certainly not equipped to answer that question, and Margaret and any of So how do you deal with sensitive issues like, well, the example was union issues. Yeah. So you've got to collect the evidence, which then needs to be shown to an auditor. Someone got a...
Don't you do simulated?
I'm not sure about that, Melanie. Bronwyn Campbell from Active Learning Partners. I generally tell my students that anything confidential will only be seen by the assessor, so your comment that the auditor needs to see it is an interesting one, because as far as I'm concerned, the auditor only needs to see an assessor's signature that they have seen or interviewed that person on that particular issue. So I'd be interested perhaps in Margaret's comment.
Yeah, I mean, I think we would respect that if it was confidential information, as long as the process is fine. I think that would be fine with us.
Oh, that's encouraging, yeah. Because that's certainly what we do. We have an assessor that is the only person that sees that confidential information. Okay. And the students made very clear to the student that that's the only person. And if we want to keep any part of what is considered potentially confidential, we will seek their permission. So I hope that helps.
Okay, Stuart. Good.
And interview process is a very strong part of that as well, so that we actually collect their the way they've dealt with some things that perhaps may not be documented.
Any other comments, questions? Okay.
I really just have a comment. I'm a new to the TAFE sector, and I have found an incredible distance between alienating students by using e-learning. We assume that we all have these technologies in our homes, or they have them in their homes. And quite often, well, I did a survey, a third of my students who were learning computers did not have access to a computer at home, did not own a mobile phone or could afford one. And there was a cultural distance there too. A lot of the female students in building were not allowed to have those types of communication. So if you're using that as an assessment tool, it became very difficult to make that available for all students. That's just a comment that I found quite challenging when I was starting to use e-learning practices in the classroom.
And I think it's important. I think Margaret referred to an appropriate and integrated, a blended model. So, I mean, obviously that's not a one-size-fits-all, and you may have people in your group who have access and competence at those technologies and should be allowed that option, but it's not that it has to be that for everybody. Stefan, is there a question online from Adobe? Can you read the mic down the back with Stefan?
Yeah, there is one here that's come via Twitter, and the question is, who owns digital assessments? The student, the RTO, the employer? And how do students carry that evidence with them?
The audience can answer as
well. Assessment tool would be owned by the RTO. The student would fill it in and submit it to the RTO, and the RTO would assess it and would make a decision about whether or not they needed to keep it.
And I suppose an example of that is something like on YouTube, and I've seen lots of that kind of thing, and you'll find them. So what an organisation, the issue an organisation has is where to put that stuff often, and the only option is to put it on web storage so it doesn't belong to the organisation. And if a student moves to another state, for example, can they still tap into that and use that as valid evidence of something they've done elsewhere?
But the student basically doesn't need to keep their evidence forever. You don't need to keep the evidence forever. You need when you complete your unit or your qualification, you'll get your testament to say that you have that qualification. You don't need the evidence any longer. And the RTO doesn't need to keep the evidence for 30 years.
Is there a time frame that they need to keep evidence?
Well, they should keep evidence for the period of the qualification and issuing the qualification. And after that, they don't need to keep the evidence unless, of course, there's a condition on them from VTAB to keep their evidence so that we can see it. Mm-hmm. But routinely, they don't need to keep all the evidence. They need to keep the records.
Thanks, Margaret.
The records that
count. Would it still belong to the student though? For instance, if they do an assessment that it might be producing a PowerPoint slideshow that's to educate their class on a topic or something.
Yeah.
Now, is that belong to them if they go out and become an educator themselves? Can they still use that as to educating other people? That's still theirs forever.
Yes, I guess it's something that's made and it's theirs, even and if they want to keep a copy of it, but they have submitted that as their assessment to the RTO.
Okay, so the RTO would have to have permission from the student to use that themselves?
Well, if they wanted to use it for teaching purposes, yes.
It's not actually a question, it was just confirming there that from a copyright perspective, the student owns their own work, so whatever they've done, they get to keep it. If they want to use it as evidence in the e-portfolios and things, that's technically fine.
Thanks, Vanessa. Okay, Vivian, one last comment or question from the middle of the room here. Vivian, over here.
Comment I heard a number of years ago, it was actually from Lee Blackhall, and he was involved in a learning management system as a student, and because at the end of the course all that information that he'd given in discussion threads, information that he put up on the web, it was locked off, and so he no longer had access to it. So I think we need to consider that, and he was certainly reflecting on the fact that he had to sort of try and keep all that evidence, but that's not always possible. So the learning management systems that we use, if they're not open to the web, are no longer accessible, be reused in other forms of assessment as evidence he could use in his e-portfolio. It was therefore locked away and gone. So I think we need to consider that as educators as well, as to the ownership of that information.
And obviously there will be a lot more tools that will satisfy that problem in the coming years, but Moodle is one. Moodle is the first off the cab. Middle of next year we'll actually have an export to Mahara option, so any content in that course a student can choose to put it in their own e-portfolio. I'm sure we could go on, but we need to wrap it up. Before we wrap the session up, Annie would like to talk to us for another minute about an opportunity for you all to take part in the research.
Thanks, Michael. And there's a debate that
you know, it confirms to me why we are actually involved in this research, and there are many issues and we haven't got all the answers. But I really, really encourage you, and Berwyn and Victor, who are undertaking this research, will be really, really keen to hear from you, or any issues that you think, particularly of that last issue, very, very, very important things that they haven't thought about, but really need to be in the mix. And so in the foyer we have the reception desk. We have a little bit of information about the research, the email, and you might like to send that in hard copy, electronically, contact Victor or Berwyn and get involved in the debate. It'll be going on for early next year, and contribute to this research. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all. I would just like to highlight a couple of things that I heard Margaret say that I think we should really just kind of latch onto, that basically nothing is out of the question and they appreciate engagement. It's not black and white. It's up to us in some occasions, in some cases, to make our own case for why we think that's fair and valid assessment. Margaret, thank you very much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. And Annie, and thank you all.
I'd like to thank Michael Coughlin, also for leading a great panel for us this morning.
Thanks, Melanie. Thank you.